Hey everybody, and welcome to Back Issues, the only comic podcast that thinks sitting around at 9 p.m. on a Saturday night recording about comic books is the height of cool. I'm your host Jason. With me today are Dick, Jamie, and John.
Hi.
Hello.
So this week we're discussing a classic Alan Moore story from way the hell back in 1985. Alan Moore writing, Dave Gibbons doing art, and fair warning, we're going to spoil the entire damn thing for you. If you don't like it, turn off now. Please don't turn off now. we're going to be talking Superman Annual number 11 for The Man Who Has Everything. Put it this way, a Superman story that I actually like. Because I can't stand Superman. So, the basic plot is Batman, Robin, who at the time was actually Jason Todd, the short-lived second Robin, and Wonder Woman, all visit the Fortress of Solitude with gifts for Superman on his birthday. Well, they go to give him the gifts, and they find Superman standing there like a statue with this heinous freaking plant thing on his chest.
Black Mercy.
Yeah. As they take a look at, you know, the situation, out pops one of Superman's nemesis, Mongol, who is like 12 foot freaking tall and built like a brick shit house. He tells the three heroes about the plant, the Black Mercy, and how it's put Superman to a coma based on his fondest dream.
What his heart most desires.
Yeah, what his heart desires most, yeah. And, well, Superman's in a dream state. He thinks he's, you know, living a normal life back on Krypton. He's married, got two children. His dad, you know, is still alive. His mom's not, but so yeah. Wonder Woman decides to fight Mongol, and Mongol kind of starts whipping her ass. Batman and Robin try to free Superman. While this is going on, before this is going on, Mongol says Superman could come out anytime he wants to. He just has to want to. So while they're, you know, Wonder Woman's fighting and Batman and Robin are trying to get this thing off of him, Superman's fantasy starts getting really weird and dark. His father becomes a bitter asshole. His mother's died from an eating sickness. You know, and his brother has died, and there's tensions with his sister-in-law and niece that it, like, starts getting bad for Superman. I mean, granted, this whole thing is a dream sequence, so it really doesn't matter other than it's what Superman's experiencing. There's a drive to restore the Phantom Zone criminals, calling the Phantom Zone, like, cruel and unusual punishment kind of thing. There's extremist movements going on within Krypton itself. There's fighting. So Superman's dream is getting bleaker as people try to bring him out of the state. Out of the, you know, comatose state. There's a really kind of, I don't want to say touching, it's not the right word, but like, gripping scene where Superman is sitting there talking to his son and he's just like, I don't believe you're real. You know? But yeah, Superman, you know, wakes up after, you know, saying that he doesn't think his son's real. And, you know, Batman tries to pry the Black Mercy off, winds up getting slapped with it on him. He has a dream that is the shot that killed the first shot at his parents missed, and, you know, they survived that whole thing. They don't really show a lot of Batman's
fantasy world,
yeah. Other than, you know, Thomas Wayne disarms, at the time it was Joe Chill who killed him. That's been overwritten so many times, though.
Right.
And then Superman, like, lets out this huge freaking, like, scream of Mongol that shakes the entire place, and then flies off to beat the crap out of Mongol. Robin takes Mongol's gauntlets and tries to pry the Black Mercy off Batman and stuff it into the gauntlet. Meantime, Superman's, like, beating Mongol across the Fortress of Solitude, causing all tons of damage. And what wins the day is, Robin, actually. Robin drops the Black Mercy on Mongol when Mongol's getting ready to kind of sucker punch Superman. And Mongol winds up trapped by the Black Mercy in his own deepest fantasy. Which has him, you know, swatting the Black Mercy aside, killing Robin, rips off Superman's head and all this other shit, and just takes over the Earth and eventually the universe. So the superheroes are left standing at the end, and they start trading notes. Batman finally does explain, what his fantasy was, which was marrying Kathy Kane and having a daughter. Wonder Woman reveals that she kind of wishes she had, you know, seen what her heart's desire was. And Superman says, you know, I'm going to dump Mongol off in a black hole on the other side of the galaxy. Because he's still got the Black Mercy attached to him, so he's comatose. And then Superman, you know, opens his gifts. It kind of just ends. Wonder Woman gives him a replica of the Battle City of Kandor. Batman tried to get somebody to breed a new species of rose, but it got crushed during the fight. Then Superman, you know, pretty much says, somebody make me some coffee, and while he cleans up.
Yeah.
And it ends with Mongol's, you know, Black Mercy dream. You know, the stars run red, the nebulae echo the streams of the dying, and Mongol's just sitting there all happy, and, you know, having destroyed and killed everyone in his way. So yeah, classic story.
Mm-hmm.
Really well told.
Yeah.
So, yeah, what'd you guys think?
Go ahead, Dan.
Oh, no, you go ahead first.
Oh, all right. I thought it's a short story. It's pretty simple. I kind of wish they had put, that there would had been more, we could see more of the, Kryptonian society of Superman's dreams, because I thought that was getting interesting right up until the time he yanks himself out of it. And, I think there was a lot of, potential there to explore that more, and I'm kind of sad that they didn't. As for the rest of the story, I don't think it's a bad story, but it almost comes across as a Super Friends episode to me.
There is a rip-off.
Like a rabbit. Plot.
This was adapted in 2004 for an episode of Justice League Unlimited.
It was, so, you know, as you can see. But, also you get a look at the Batman's heart desire, which is just pretty predictable. I'm not really aware of Mongol too much. I'm not really well versed in Superman or his mythos. Well, I know about the mythos, but I don't really know much about his rogues gallery aside from the big foes, i.e., Lex Luthor, Brainiac, Bizarro, etc., etc. But that's it. I think they could have gone more into that. I would have liked it a little bit more. That could have been a separate story on its own, I think. But
I'm not going to lie. It's an interesting way to try and, in air quotes, kill Superman. But at the same time, it's kind of a lame way to kill Superman because he's the Man of Steel, so he kind of has an iron will. So eventually he probably would have, you know, gotten out on his own without them pulling it off of him pretty much. And he would have been fine. It, like, he would have found Mongol and kicked his ass. But,
which he did. Know,
yeah. But it's just like, it's an interesting idea, but it just feels like the execution was sort of, just, yeah, sort of like
ham-fisted. A ham-fisted?
Yeah, ham-fisted, kind of forced. I mean, it works for a story. At the same time, it's, I don't know, it just felt very anticlimactic.
Yeah, I agree with that.
You know what's strange is this is the first story I've ever read with Jason Todd that didn't involve him getting beaten with a crowbar and blown up.
I mean,
really?
I mean, that's the fun one.
Yeah.
Anything involving Jason Todd and a crowbar is always going to be a good time. Not for Jason Todd, obviously.
Well, I mean, I've read his stuff as the Red Hood and shit, but I've never read anything of him as Robin.
As Robin,
this.
Yeah.
Except for the aforementioned crowbar beating and blowing up.
Oh, those were the days. Anyway, I have a slightly different opinion, I think, to you two, in that I absolutely loved reading this again, because I think I suspect Jason might agree with me on this. This was prior to like Watchmen being a thing.
Yep.
Prior to the Dark Knight Returns. This is, you know, prior to basically the modern age of comic books, which has been going since 1985. This was at the very, very sort of cusp between the like Bronze Age, which is, you know, all the sci-fis, Green Lantern coming back in, you know, as a different character, Flash coming back as a different character and everything, and the modern age, which was after Watchmen and everything got really dark and gritty and violent. This was like right in between those two periods. So this was a time when comic books were still basically happy and light and, you know, not the sort of absurd 40s Batman dresses up in multiple colours and every week Superman takes down Lex Luthor and says, "You won't be able to buy that land, Lex Luthor, you bald fuck you." You know, obviously in, you know, 1940s terminology. But this was really kind of it was good, I think, for me to read a story like this that was just one issue of a comic book, part of an ongoing, you know, series. It wasn't connected to anything. It never really became anything after this. There wasn't any foreshadowing for this. It was a one-off villain called Mongol that had been in a few stories in the 60s. That was about it. But it really got nailed the character for me in one issue. It nailed it. This idea of is Superman and he's a god amongst insects, basically. How would you go about taking that down? You can't do it physically. You do it by magic, but that's another thing. But tempting the human side of him, tempting the, you know, farm boy raised in a backwater in Kansas, tempting that part of him to give himself over to something that he knows is fake, because that's eventually how he gets out of it, like you said, Dick. He eventually realizes that this is all bullshit, this isn't real, this is a fantasy. But there's a moment when he says to his son, "I don't think you're real, but just let me hug you for one last time." That temptation is something that really hadn't been done before up until that point. And I think I enjoyed it a lot more just from a historical perspective. Because if I was reading this, you know, and I wasn't familiar with comic books and I wasn't familiar with the character, I'd basically just go, "Oh, okay, yeah, that's the story." But because I know the character so well and I know how comics developed after this, I loved it. I thought it was amazing. It's an amazing way to do a single issue of a comic book that's not like a 12 issue event or something like that. I absolutely loved it.
Those are excellent points.
And I think you nailed something really big. Like, this is the time in comic history we're kind of stepping away from the single, you know, self-contained issues and moving more into multi-issue story arcs, you know? Where everything's got a storyline, you know, behind it and pushing it. But this was a throwback to, you know, the good old days where you put down 25 cents and you get one full story, you know? And I think that was definitely something noteworthy about it. You know, like, even for this podcast, we're so used to having to read anywhere from, you know, 5 to 66 issues. But this is just one single, you know, insular story that fit perfectly between cover to cover. And I feel like they didn't waste any time with it either. There's no single page where something isn't happening. There's no filler. It's kind of like, you know, perfectly crafted. And I'm kind of rambling with it.
Oh, no, yeah. You're fine. You're making good points, too.
Yeah, that's a good point, like, because there's a lot in there. I mean, to be honest, I think this would make for a really good kind of maybe a 3-issue miniseries or something, maybe an Elseworlds, if you really delve into the like history of Krypton and what his life would be like, because a lot of the stuff was kind of just sort of vaguely referred to, which Alan Moore's, like, that's one of his really good strengths, is he's able to just pull every little bit of information of a character's backstory and just make a nice little nod to him, a little reference. He doesn't have to go into like, oh, who is this person? Who is this person? It's just had little sort of hints as to what the society would be like on Krypton if it hadn't have been destroyed. But again, that's something that, again, you can kind of go like, well, I would have loved to have seen more of that. But at the time, it was just limited by the number of pages more than anything else. Yeah. But I would, yeah, like you say, I would love to see more kind of exploration of this. With the caveat that someone like Alan Moore writes it. Because if you had most comic books writing it, they'd explore every little tiny detail of the society, completely take the mystery out, and it'd be crap.
I agree.
I want to say one thing, and it really just shows, you know, I might not have really had the appreciation you two guys did, but I can say that I can definitely appreciate, as you say, it's a strong story. It has, you could say, it says no filler. It's definitely the kind of good writing that you expect from Alan Moore. You know, it's just, you know, that he can take a simple story and still make it powerful.
Yeah. And another really, something that speaks to the character of Superman deeply is his greatest, you know, wish, his fantasy, his, you know, fondest desire is a reality where he doesn't have his powers.
Mm-hmm.
He would trade all of his godlike powers for to have his family back. I think that speaks a lot to his character. Because I don't know that in that situation my fondest dream wouldn't be closer to Mongols, you know? It's like, I've got all this power. You're all my bitches now, you know?
Jason, that does not surprise me at all.
It would turn out a lot closer to the Arkham miniseries than it would this, you know?
Mm. Yeah.
I do have to say it is interesting to see what Superman's life could have been like, though, definitely. Although, what's interesting about that is how, once he starts to realize it's fake and something feels off, the fantasy starts to slowly collapse, you know? Because his dad is leading a separatist group and stuff, and then it gets darker and darker and darker until it gets to the point where he's outside of town in the giant crater, you know? And he wants to hold his son to make sure that his son is real. and everything. And it's really interesting to look at that and how as Superman sort of became aware of the improbability of the situation he was in more and more and more, it became darker and darker and took a more and more turn until finally there's a whirlwind and he's out and, you know, Batman's being basically fed on now, you know?
And it's funny. Even Batman's, you know, hallucination thing, dream state, he gives up being Batman. It's like, almost like everybody's fondest wish is just for a reality where they didn't have to do this. Where they didn't have to put on, you know, the tights and capes and run around beating up the bad guys. They could just be content with what they had. And I think that speaks a lot to the psychology of the superhero, you know?
Yeah, definitely. A lot of heroes feel like they're unwilling heroes, you know? They feel like that. It feels like they're doing this because they have to, not because they want to. In a lot of cases, with a lot of heroes, both in DC and Marvel, just in general. I mean, yeah, there's obviously a lot of you know, examples of heroes who want to be heroes or want to kick ass because they can in both camps as well, but it's definitely a common theme that eventually, after a while, you know, these heroes want nothing to do with their powers anymore, the responsibility that comes with protecting people.
Absolutely. That's actually one of the key kind of themes of the modern age of comic books, especially when it started, was just this idea that they want to run away from being a hero because maybe they can't take the responsibility, maybe they don't like what it's doing to the loved ones, maybe they're just kind of sick of it. You know, that was definitely one of the, especially in Watchmen, that's one of the, you know, the key kind of points of the story is just after a while, you're just so sick of it, you want a normal life. So it's interesting to kind of see like the roots of it coming into, in all places, a Superman story.
Yeah, that is pretty unique in its own right. And it's just, part of me kind of is with Wonder Woman. It's like, I want to know what hers would have been like, you know? What would she have seen had she taken on the Black Mercy?
It would have been the wish for a good live-action film starring Wonder Woman.
It doesn't look bad, you know?
That's the one I'm most looking forward to. So
It looks formulaic. I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing.
Nah, I'm all about that.
Yeah, but, you know, it's interesting that you point this out, because it comes back to, I don't know who liked this quote, but best leader is someone who doesn't want to lead, and that would give it up if he could. You know, and, you know, that's what they try to be, is, you know, not necessarily leaders, but heroes, in that sense. They would prefer a world where they weren't needed.
I think, I can't remember what storyline or who said it, but I believe it was in Justice League. It might have even been Batman that said it. It's like, pretty much was like, isn't that why we exist, so that one day we don't have to?
Yeah. I think that comes out of Roman philosophy, though, if I'm not.
Don't give me the lion. I don't know that much about Roman philosophy.
Well, it was something that Washington, George Washington, was very big on, was that idea that the best leaders are the ones who, best leaders, best heroes are ones who don't want the burden, but take it up because it has to be there. Now, it's what I'm saying is you know, it's always the man who's greedy for power will just take more and more and more and more and more. But a good man will surrender that power when it's no longer needed.
Yeah, that does make sense.
And in the words of Uncle Ben, with great power comes great responsibility.
Yeah.
I think that's applicable to any comic, any hero. You know, the Superman is Superman because he's the only person with those particular powers that, you know, has the mindset of I want to help people. Other people, perhaps, you know, people of less character would go, well, I've got all this power, I'm gonna tear the universe in half. Jason, I'm looking at you.
Hey, I put away the Infinity Gauntlet.
It was Plato who said that, actually.
Ah.
Oh, yes, of course.
I got the second Roman Greeks up sometimes.
Well, let's be fair. I might tear the universe in half, but I'm really only doing it because I want to be left alone.
You're doing it because you're bored.
Yeah.
You're like Mr. Mixelpick. You'd just be like, I'll just create drugs as my one weakness.
Weakness? That's where I get my power, dude.
Oh, you're the Green Lantern of drugs. Instead of willpower.
I'm like Snow... what was that fucking Snowflame?
Oh my god, Snowflame. A hero powered by cocaine.
I'm the spiritual successor, man.
Oh, the 80s were crazy.
It's interesting to me. A very similar storyline to that was done in Star Trek Generations, which was the 7th Star Trek movie.
Yeah.
Have you guys seen that or are familiar with it?
Yep.
Yeah, where Picard ends up in the Nexus, which is shows him what a world he truly desires, and then it also and he meets Kirk in there because he's able to shrug it off, and then it points out and then Kirk also shrugs off. It points out the iron will of the hero, so to speak. You know, that visions and you know, it's not for them. They need to be. They need to go where they're needed, not where they want to be. They can't just, you know, take a powder when millions of people are about to die.
Eh, why not? Maybe they should have died. I'd make a really shitty hero.
I think most people would.
Yeah. If you were a hero, who would you be? You'd probably be like...
I'd be like a fucked up Frank Castle. I'd shoot the dealers, then do their
drugs. You'd be Punisher, definitely. Or Deathstroke, I was thinking. You'd be Deathstroke.
It's like, hey, look, a drug dealer. Pop. Sweet, I'm going to steal his stash.
Oh, so you'd... So you'd be Cassidy, then?
Yeah.
I did, all right, so I'm actually mentioning this to Jason prior to starting recording. I actually watched the Justice League Unlimited episode yesterday, just because after having read the comic, I was like, how good was that episode? Because I watched it, and I watched it years ago, so I couldn't really remember. So I went back and I watched it, and it's incredible. Like, it's almost, I mean, they take Robin out of it, so Jason Todd's not in it. It's just Batman and Wonder Woman, that's it. Some of the things are slightly different, like the fantasy that Batman has is just like his father stops him getting shot and stuff. But it's more or less the exact story of the comic. And it's so good because just like the level of emotion that you get out of the voice acting and the animation's so like good in how they do it. I don't really know how they do it because... Just get the sense of, like, in a comic, Mongol says to Superman, getting out of it must have been like tearing off your arm, just because of the sheer, like, you know, horror and the unwillingness to do it, to get out of your ultimate happy world. In the animation, though, in the cartoon, it's just like the look on his face when he realizes what's happened, and that's... His life's been robbed from him, and he's actually on Earth, and he's not got a family. It's just astonishing for a kids TV show. That is just fantastic.
And I will say, I think that's one of the more true to the original Alan Moore adaptations.
Absolutely, yeah.
And it's definitely the one that didn't lose. It lost the least in translation.
Are you referring to the Killing Joke there, by any chance?
Oh. I'm the Killing Joke, Watchmen, all of them, you know?
Yeah.
I think that every time you translate Alan Moore, every time somebody translates Alan Moore, they lose so much of what he intended with the original comic.
You mean you didn't like the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen?
Who did?
With a car chase scene through Venice. and a big monster at the end.
Here's my prime one. V for Vendetta, right?
Yes.
You remember the comic.
Oh, yes.
There was no good guy in that comic.
Oh, no.
Everybody existed in the gray between. I mean, some were darker than others, but nobody was pure good or evil.
I mean, yeah, the main protagonist is a terrorist.
Yeah. An unabashed terrorist at that.
Mm-hmm.
But the movie, they polarize it so obvious good guy, obvious bad guy. Like, that kind of stuff. A lot of Alan Moore stuff doesn't, you know, polarize well. And they always try to polarize it in the adaptations.
It's weird how, like, especially when it comes to comics, if they ever try and do a single story, for example, From Hell was a fucking atrocious film.
Yep.
Like you were saying, V for Vendetta, which actually I quite liked, but it completely divorced from the book. But when they try and do a single translation of a comic, especially Alan Moore, because he's so complex in his writing, they always fuck it up. It's not until you get like a, almost like, I hate saying it, but like a reboot of a character for films. Like, Iron Man's successful, not because it takes a single story or single issue or run. It's like drawing from elements of everything. And you can't really do that with an Alan Moore book, because it's just like, it's so well written and so well thought out and so well planned that you have to go like direct scene for scene translation, which in the case of Justice League Unlimited worked because it's a short story and it's also a short show, you know, 20 minutes, and it's like, you know, 30 page comic, you know, that translates. When you get something like a From Hell, which is an absolutely massive book, you try and condense that into 90 minutes and also cast Johnny Depp, then you lose 99% of what made it good.
Yep.
Mostly because of Johnny Depp. Fucking cunt.
The only times I really enjoy Johnny Depp are when he's doing a Hunter S. Thompson work.
Yes, actually, that's good. Him as Spider Jerusalem in like early 2000s would have been the best.
I could see it. Actually, the weird part is I had an old English teacher in high school that if you took the tattoos off Spider, dead fucking ringer, man.
Yeah. Draw him on.
And it's like, he was an actor too, and it's just like, we should do this. But
that'd
yeah.
That'd be pretty fantastic. Like, but yeah, like, as I said earlier, like, it was really good to see Alan Moore, I guess, reined in a little bit, because some of his latter stuff, it tends to be a bit really heavy-handed, some of it, with his philosophy, which is fascinating. But he can be a little bit...
heavy-handed?
He can turn his work into a little bit of a diatribe sometimes. Especially like, oh, I worship this chaos god who's a snake. I'm not actually joking. That's genuinely what he believes. But it was great to see him very much reined in.
And another really great thing, honestly, about this comic is seeing him work with Dave Gibbons.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, that's another one of those, you know, creative teams right there that always works.
Yeah, like we talked about with the We Three
couple of
issues ago.
Grant Morrison, Frank Whiteley.
If you get a certain pair of writer and artist together, it can just make it magic.
I mean, how much of, you know, Watchmen just visually in the comics is iconic, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this was, at this point, they had started writing Watchmen, right?
Yeah.
If I recall. So they've been working together for a little bit. And it's interesting to, like, again, see, like, parallels between Watchmen and this. Certainly with some of the scenes where Superman's breaking out of his dream for the first time. get this like look of horror on his face, and you get this look of like despair in his son's face as he starts to fade away. And that's like, it really mirrors some of the stuff in Watchmen, especially when Dr. Manhattan's, when he basically vaporizes, spoilers for Watchmen, which I'm sure everyone in the world has read by this point. When he vaporizes, you get this really similar kind of art style, and it just a little bit of echoes that reminded me. And again, it's something I thought was just to get a pairing like that on just, you know, a random issue of Superman. That's amazing.
Exactly. And they do create just that fucking magic with this issue.
Absolutely.
You know, a perfect, you know, rundown of Superman's psychology. You know, a pretty good, you know, action sequence. I mean, for fuck's sake, they describe Superman's intensity of his eye beams as being like that of a sun. You know, you get a Superman who's not really holding back. And that's tough to do. Or tough to, like, work in a comic, because Superman, you know, not holding back, you're talking a man who could punch the ground and crack the planet in half.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And seeing him go all out against Mongol, which, you know, Mongol is supposed to be nearly the same power level as Superman, like, pure strength-wise. You know, it's almost up there with, like, Superman and Darkseid fighting, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Which, it's funny, actually. When I start, when you told us that this is the book we're going to read, in my mind, for some reason, I thought it was Darkseid. Like, maybe it's the art style, maybe it's just because I automatically insert Darkseid into comics for some reason. But for some reason, when he was like Mongol, I was like, oh, it's not Darkseid. Okay. But I think it's more than anything, it's because of the fight. And that is a Darkseid Superman level fight at the end of this book. Like, that is the fight that they would have without question.
And then, like, you gotta admit, this is a Darkseid style story, too. This would be something he'd do to a T.
Oh, yeah. Without question.
Especially, he's like, all I gotta do is give him what he wants? Okay.
Just get this weird plant thing. Throw it at him.
Granted, if it had also been Darkseid, he wouldn't have just left Superman sitting there in the fortress. He would have brought him back to Apocalypse and done screwed up things with the body.
Yeah, encased him in concrete. Or kryptonite. Or kryptonite concrete.
Whoa. Encrypted concrete, dude?
Kryptonite concrete. God damn, how stoned are you?
Not nearly enough. Not nearly.
But yeah, no. This story is pretty good for what it is. You know, I definitely remembered that this was a cartoon shortly before recording. I confirmed with Jason. I was like, "This was a cartoon, wasn't it?" And he's like, "Yeah, yeah, it was." And I was like, "Oh, I remember this one." And it's pretty good. It feels very campy to me, but I can see how it's dark and it's a departure from your standard sort of superhero saves the day kind of a story.
I mean, this story is so iconic. It even got an action figure back in 2006. A Justice League Superman figure that came with the Black Mercy. Which, you know, obviously, you know, the generic kid who's going to pick that up and be like, what the hell is this thing? But their parents who, you know, read the comics would be like, hey. I mean, hell, before we recorded this episode earlier today, I was talking to my dad about this issue. Because it's one he remembers from when I was a little kid. Because, like, my dad literally got me into comic collecting. But, like, he remembered it better than I did. Which was kind of impressive, considering I'm the one that's supposed to know it to be able to run the show. I don't do good at my job, I swear.
Is your dad secretly the brains behind the operation?
No, but he is pretty much a producer at this point.
Oh, fair enough.
I mean, he's the one, like, going, do you know how to do this with it? Oh, okay. Hey, run this storyline. Okay. Hell, at some point, I'm going to try to get him on the show.
And then his power will be complete.
The ascension.
He will turn out to be the dark side of this podcast.
Yeah. I don't think it's going to be that bad. Yeah, I mean, I'm looking through, like, the Wikipedia page for this comic. It's been reprinted so many fucking times. 1, 2, 3, 4 different trade paperbacks. One of them being hardcover. I mean, literally, this story is in the greatest Superman stories ever told.
Well, that makes sense, really. I mean, as we've seen, the storyline has been, not only been reused, but inspired other media. So, yeah, it makes sense.
Yeah. And I gotta admit, though, the Mongol's little dream sequence is so powerful to me. So, I mean, he not only kills, you know, all the heroes, he does it in the most brutal ways possible. Like, he just, like, pummels Jason Todd. And,
yeah,
tears Superman's head off. I mean, what kind of rage, when you're fighting someone, you know, you punch him in the fucking throat or something, collapse their windpipe and kill him. Who goes, I'm going to rip off a motherfucker's head? You just never see that kind of ferocity anymore.
Like Hulk-level ferocity right there.
No, not even Hulk. Hulk just ripped the entire person in half. This is just I want his head.
Well, then that's just not ferocity. That's just plain being an asshole.
Also, what the hell kind of strength would it take to tear off Superman's head?
I don't, but he really done it, though. It is in his mind.
True, but now I'm really wondering what it would take to do that. That's like up there with what's it take to break adamantium.
Good question. Or vibranium.
Also, I kind of find it funny that Batman came to give Superman a genetically engineered rose, and then it was another plant that got the whole storyline started. I mean, it's like, you just tore this mind-altering plant off of me, and now you want to give me another plant? Batman, you're a dick.
Yeah.
I mean, Batman is a dick.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Also, well, Superman, so... You know.
I think Superman's like a more of a, oh, I'm so good, look at me.
Right.
It's kind of like the vegan of superheroes.
Constantly has to tell you that he's vegan.
I think that's interesting. I think that's why there's kind of an underlying dislike of Superman. Because I think a lot of people see him as kind of a blunt instrument and kind of, well, a dick.
I think a lot of people see him as kind of like a Boy Scout, and they're just not interested.
Right.
That's where, you know, characters like the Punisher and...
kind of one-dimensional.
Well, certainly like from his initial origin stories. It's when you get certain stories like this where there's an angle on it. You know, you can take a certain aspect of the character, or you can take something in the past or some kind of weakness with them. You can take it and, you know, exploit it, which Alan Moore did. But most of the time, they just write him like, oh, he's a god, he can do what everyone wants. And that's just boring.
Like, my real problem with Superman has always been, it's impossible to kill him, so where's the danger, you know? Oh, people around him could die, so what? Superman himself,
did die.
He got better.
Time it did. Exactly, and he got a mullet. That's a real weakness, is bad hair.
But I mean, it's like, you got a man with two weaknesses, kryptonite and magic, right? Sure, you got Metallo, who's, you know, powered by kryptonite,
mm-hmm.
and like the kryptonite, all that kind of shit. You never see, like, Superman having an adversary that's based in completely in magic.
No.
No, you don't see that often enough.
Why? Because John Constantine can take this motherfucker out. And Constantine's just
that'd be amazing.
Oh, yeah. It'd be quick fight, though.
Given that weakness, there's plenty of people in DC that should technically be able to put Superman on his back.
Etrigan, Zatanna.
Those two were the first ones that popped into my head.
Zatara, of course. Constantine, definitely.
That I think about it, it's probably because this is a Superman story. It didn't exactly wow me.
Yeah.
I don't really think I was wowed either, but I understand the
appeal.
What you guys say in its defense. Yeah.
Oh yeah, no, definitely. It's definitely an important story, and I understand the importance historically behind it, but I think looking back on it, when after comics got real gritty and such, you know, the modern comic era, I think it kind of looks almost like a quaint nod looking back at it. But looking from where it came from, it was a step toward that modern comic era. If that makes sense.
It really does. And further to that point as well, I think that's why it's so hard now. To get a good Superman story, or at least like an iconic one. I mean, the one that a lot of people talk about now is All-Star Superman. That's like, you know, up there with pretty much the best Superman story there is. But what it goes to show is, like, you can't make a dark and gritty Superman. It has never worked, and it will never, ever work. It's like why I think that in my opinion, let me preface it with that, in my opinion, the current DC film universe that they're making doesn't work because the tone is just all wrong. But the reason that, like, All-Star Superman was so good, it wasn't dark and gritty at all. This comic we're talking about today, it's not dark and gritty. It's just the character as he is. He is... the ultimate superhero, is the ultimate good guy, and it's really hard to write that. The idea of going, well, just make him dark and gritty, that doesn't work because that's not who the character is at all. And people are so used now to having characters like the Punisher and Deadpool and the modern interpretation of Batman, that's what they're used to, and that's what they find interesting, that's what they find compelling. But that's not who Superman is at all. And every time they've tried to make it like that, they've failed.
Yeah. Oh, and there's another reference to this comic. The Supergirl live-action series did a version called For the Girl Who Has Everything.
Oh.
Oh, really?
Yeah, except for instead of Mongol, it's Non.
Oh, yeah. Wait, Non. Hang on.
As in the criminal from Superman 2?
Yeah, Zod's mate.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's unexpected. Have you watched any of the Supergirl TV series?
No, I'll be honest. If you put Super in front of it, I'm not going to really give a damn.
Yeah, it does not appeal to me at all.
I mean, the last time I watched a Superman TV show was actually the Superman animated series in the 90s.
Which was really, really good.
Lois
and Clark.
The one with Dean Cain.
Yeah, Lois and Clark. I actually did watch that back in the day.
That one wasn't terrible. But yeah, the Superman animated series is probably the best one out there.
Oh, and back to Darkseid fights, that the last episode when he just cuts loose on Darkseid. Oh.
Yeah, that was satisfying.
That's, That's one of has one of my favorite speeches in it, where he goes like, "I live in a world of cardboard."
Yeah.
Oh, so good.
It's like, I have to spend every moment of my life holding back. It's like, but you, I don't have to hold back against you.
Yeah.
It's like, goddamn, Superman. The moment when Superman completely just went berserk, you know? Channeled his inner Wolverine.
And to bring back what you were guys were saying before, that is why you cannot have a dark Superman, because, you know, they've kind of painted him into a corner by giving him so much power. You know, and that's why every time you see a Superman story where he comes like that, it's always in an alternate universe, and he's always a villain. They just can't, like you said, you cannot write him that way. It's impossible.
It's actually really, really interesting as well, I think. I'm gonna slightly spoil All-Star Superman, but it's what I'm about to say happens within the first three pages. So take it at your risk. The reason that All-Star Superman is so effective is throughout the entire thing, he's dying.
Yep.
Like, he's got a clock running against him. It's just like, oh, I'm going to die, so I need to like finish my life's work and prepare the world for a world without Superman.
Don't spoil it too much, because that is an upcoming episode at some point.
Absolutely, and that's all I shall say on the matter.
But yeah, I mean, like I said, I'm not a Superman fan, but I can still appreciate comics like this.
Yeah.
And I can definitely, I always appreciate Alan Moore, you know?
Oh yeah, well, Alan Moore is just...
He's a crazy motherfucker, but I love him.
Well, you know what they say, truly talented people are, their true genius comes with madness.
Yeah. And Alan Moore is the perfect poster child for that, because the dude is off his rocker. I mean, we could have an entire episode just based on his exploits, you know?
But am I wrong in saying that this storyline is a little campy?
No, you're not. It's like I said way back at the beginning, you know, it felt kind of like a Super Friends episode.
Yeah.
A very short, very concise, a villain that was very one-dimensional. Had kind of aspects that you wouldn't normally see in superhero stories. We're throwing Superman a birthday party, you know, it's like, but yeah, it still works, you know.
I mean, to its credit, that's probably why, I guess, the stark contrast between that and the seriousness of what goes on when Superman and Batman are both under the effects of it, I guess, is a good counterpoint, but it definitely feels very campy.
Like John and I both said, this is kind of at a point where there is a change in tone of comics.
Yeah, you are at the end of an era, so to speak.
I mean, yeah, it's campy, but it's one of the last real campy ones, you know?
No.
Last of a dying breed kind of feel.
But you know, there is something to be said for those kind of stories that are simple. Not necessarily simple, but very kind of like, you know, lighthearted. You don't see that much today. And, you know, it wouldn't be... I like kind of the more dark and gritty and the, you know, dramatic storylines, but, you know, I think there's a little bit of that's missing today. Kind of that old lighthearted superhero thing, to quote Squirrel Girl, where the superhero goes to the moon and fights giant monkeys.
Yeah, I definitely miss that as well. I think that such a focus now on being, I guess, true to life. That sounds weird when you're talking about Superman, but...
We did, a few weeks ago, we did the death of Captain Marvel, and you still... I'm not really familiar with that, with Marvel, but, you know, what I got to see of him, he is kind of that fantastic era superhero. He has the go across the galaxy, fight to fight alien menaces, that kind of thing. I you know, maybe that's why I like Guardians of the Galaxy so much. That was kind of a, it felt like a throwback to that.
Yeah, I can see it.
I think a lot of, I think that's a little bit, again, why you look at the contrast between DC and Marvel, the movies at least. Marvel is a lot more successful, but I think it's because the fun, in terms of that, the tone of the films is much lighter than the DC ones. And really, I think it's because people are kind of getting a little bit sick of dark superhero films. No. I mean, I'm so sick of them. I'm so sick of dark and gritty and all this sort of stuff. And reading this was a real kind of, maybe it was a throwback, but it was just really refreshing to read something that was lighthearted.
Maybe that's why Deadpool did so well, because it was, you know, a departure from that. And not only a departure, but it kind of made fun of that whole dark and gritty image.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yep, I can agree. But, well, folks, end of another good episode. In fact, this has been our 20th episode.
Hey, look at that. We made it to 20. I'm amazed.
Yeah.
We can almost drink. Well, you can in this country.
Well, folks, hope you had a good time. Please check out the comic if it appealed to you. Support your local comic shop. And if they don't have it, well, go to Amazon. That'll always work. I've been Jason. They've been John, Jamie, and Dick. And we'll see you next week.
Hey.
Hey, later.